Seth Siegel is probably a name you wouldn't recognize, but the lifelong New Yorker does have a connection to Milwaukee and to water. His first book, Let There Be Water, Israel's Solution for a Water-Starved World, was released in 2015 and subsequently became a New York Times bestseller. Since then, Siegel has spoken on water issues around the world. In 2016, UW-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences invited Siegel to become its first Senior Water Policy Fellow. The appointment allowed Siegel to dive into research for his new book, Troubled Water: What's Wrong with What We Drink? The book explores a multitude of drinking water problems that plague communities around the U.S., from contaminated wells to crumbling infrastructure. However, Siegel says the book is not meant to depress, but to inspire its readers into action. During a stop in Milwaukee earlier this month, Siegel spoke with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz about how he approached the project.
I deliberately opened the book with a town that could be in every town. It was sort of a Norman Rockwell village. If you've seen the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, it sort of evokes Bedford Falls, which is the town in the Jimmy Stewart It's a Wonderful Life film. This town is called Hoosick Falls. And it's a town of several thousand people. Everybody knows everybody. And the major industry in town were a series of factories that made the ingredients for Teflon. And they went about their business for decades. The people worked hard. They were good citizens. People volunteered. But what they didn't know was day after day, every time they drank water, every time they drank coffee, every time they made soup, every time they prepared food, they, their children, their visitors were all getting poisoned, were being contaminated by this chemical that is an active ingredient in the making of Teflon. And maybe if you just have a gulp or two of it, you're fine. But if you have a lifetime of gulps of it, you're not fine. So the story I tell here is of this man named Michael Hickey, whose father died of kidney cancer. And he was grief-stricken, as one would be, with the loss of a parent. But he also couldn't figure out why it was that his father died. It didn't make sense genetically. It didn't make sense from a family tree point of view. He wasn't a scientist. He had never taken a science or math class in college. But as he began to see other people in the town getting sick and dying in some cases, unexplained, he decided to look into it. And the point I'm sort of trying to make here is that if this person with no scientific skills could have figured out why there's this epidemic of people getting sick and dying in his town, why wouldn't that be the case almost everywhere? Why wouldn't it be the case of state EPAs or DEPs? Why wouldn't that be the case of the federal EPA? Why do we have to rely upon a Michael Hickey to raise the alarm? And so I decided to open the book by talking about Hoosick Falls and Michael Hickey as a way for the reader to understand that they're going to be brought into a world of stories of contamination that are around us, whether it's from pharmaceutical residues that get into our water from the use of pills, or whether it's from chemicals that are in our environment, or whether it's from plastic, or whether it's lead in our pipes.
So explain at this point what the EPA does regulate and how that filters down through state and into the water utilities that are managing our waters directly.
Depending on how you count it, between 100 and 120,000 chemicals of one kind or another that are in daily commerce in the United States. These are industrial solvents, these are traditional chemicals, these are pharmaceutical products, these are plastics, these are the residues of manufacturing. And not all of them by any means get into our drinking water, but many of them do. And not all of them that do probably will end up finding that they are a health hazard, but likely some are and maybe many are. We just don't know. We just are not doing enough research. So I was curious to know of the 100,000-ish, you know, a little bit more, of these chemicals that are out there. I was curious, how many of them are the EPA on top of looking out for us? And I kind of assumed as just a layperson, you know, it must be either all of them or 90% of them or 50% of them or some huge number. It turned out that the EPA had only regulated 70 chemicals and that a total of 91 contaminants. And to be regulated means that your water utility has to check for that contaminant. And if it's above a certain, what they deem as to be a health level, to bring it down to what is a healthy level. Now, that in itself was aggravating enough to discover. But when I learned that the last time any contaminant was regulated by the EPA was more than 23 years ago, I knew that we have a broken system.
Then another element of all of this is that there are so many water utilities around the country.
Yeah. So as it turns out, the way we regulate water in America is it's a three partners are involved. You have the federal government in the name of the EPA. And I've made the case elsewhere that maybe the EPA shouldn't be the one regulating it. Maybe it should be a more health-driven, public health-driven entity like Health and Human Services. But we'll put that aside for a moment. And so you have the EPA is the first leg. The second leg is the state government. And the third leg is the local utility. So I kind of assumed that a logical number of utilities would be, every state should have one. So big states like California should have maybe 6 or 8 or 10. So I came up with a number in my mind that it should be between 350 and 400 utilities would be a logical number. And then I'm reading, and the number doesn't actually, I keep thinking I'm reading something that's an error. Because it turns out that at the time I'm doing the research that there are 51,535 utilities in the United States, which means that there are tens of thousands of them that have only a few hundred customers. And if you're thinking this only means we're talking about the most rural small town of small towns, it's not the case. Because Los Angeles County itself has 200 separate utilities, and the state of California has 7,500 utilities in the state. Now, what is the consequence of that other than gross inefficiency and lots of duplication and lots of waste of money? The consequence of that is that the vast majority of these utilities don't have adequate resources to hire the most highly trained engineers, to fill all the open positions, to buy the up-to-date technology to purify the water, or to fix broken technology when it breaks. So what we have is millions of Americans are victims of the fact that we have a fractured system of water utilities with tens of thousands of them that are too small to do much of anything. Now, the EPA has a system under federal law of finding if there are violations. It's a self-reporting honor system. So in and of itself, that's a problem. But last year, there were 80,000 violations of the federal rules that were reported by these utilities. And the EPA doesn't do much of anything about that. They encourage fixing. But if you are a utility that has had a problem, say, with high arsenic levels or other high contaminants, it turns out that the state doesn't punish you very often, the federal government doesn't punish you very often. So what do we learn from that incentive? That we'll go another year without fixing it, and another year. And I found that there are hundreds of cases, thousands of cases, of communities that have multiple years of the same violation, and they're not fixing it, which means that people in their community are drinking water that is toxic, determined by federal scientists. And believe me, we're not talking about a very rigorous, tough standard. We're talking about a standard that is probably too lax. And so what lots of mayors and utilities hide behind is the fact that they are here adhering to the EPA guidelines, which leads me to say that legal does not necessarily equal safe. It's very possible that we're in a situation that the water is totally legal, but it may have PFAS or PFOA or other chemicals in it. There's no problem with that, but it doesn't mean it's safe.
So you're saying we have the technology, we have the wherewithal to fix these things, and it's doable both financially and technically.
Yes. In fact, that's a lot of people have asked me, am I an optimist or a pessimist? And I'm generally in life, I'm an optimist. Because I believe people will act rationally, even if they won't act rationally until they have no other choice. And I believe that in this situation, it's a good reason to be optimistic because we have all the solutions we need at hand. Nothing new has to be invented, although I have no doubt whatsoever that great American technological genius and other countries' great technological genius will be unleashed once we make the statement that we want to spend what we need to spend and do what we need to do to get all this right. Just using existing technologies. My argument is that water is improperly priced right now, and that by slightly raising the price of water, we can start attracting higher quality staff, give them retention so that they stick around. We can start buying the technologies that we need to fix the water, and that we will be able also to repair the broken infrastructure. Most Americans don't realize the fact that we have about 1.1 million miles of water mains in this country. It is very old. Most of it is either at or approaching the end of its useful life. Last year, we had 240,000 water main breaks in the United States. And we lose on average around the country about a third of our water to leaks. Now, as crazy as that is from an economic point of view, for those of us who are concerned about climate change, there is a vast cost in electricity in transporting and treating water. And then what do? We allow as much as a third of it to go poof up in the air. So it's believed that we could save about 6% of our national electricity bill if we would simply fix our broken infrastructure. But we can't do that as long as we have so many small utilities that have no financial capacity. They make the decision to let the pipes leak because it's too expensive to fix it, or they don't have the expertise to know how to fix it.
So where does this restructuring begin, Seth? In other words, does this need to be a lot of great brains coming together and thinking nationally or regionally or within watersheds?
So I have a simpler approach to that answer, is that I think that all of this gets fixed in a different way. I think this gets fixed by getting your WUWM listeners and listeners all over the country, but not just NPR stations and affiliates, to be informed about water issues, because I like to say that the more people know about water, the better the outcomes will be. But once we understand how contaminated our water is, how broken our system is, how lax the EPA is in regulation, once we understand all this, we will demand more. And when we demand more, what I am positive of is that the politicians of both parties will deliver more. And we like to think, perhaps, that one party is better on these issues than another party. But I will tell you from my research that what I've discovered is this is truly a bipartisan failure. Because the fact that whether it's Democrats in the White House or in Congress or Republicans in the White House or Congress, nothing has changed in decades. What happens is congressmen and senators go home for the weekend and their local utility heads badger them about not changing things because they don't want to change the pricing. Local mayors will say, I don't want to have to raise the price of water because my customers, which is to say my voters, are going to see this as a tax increase and they're going to be unhappy, and I don't want to have unhappy customers, aka voters. And so we have a system where mayors make the decision to underfund their water systems, and the price we pay for it is in less pure, less healthy water than we deserve. One way that we can fix the number of utilities and bring it way down real fast is that we could make the rule of saying to utilities that are in serial violation year after year, you fix your violations or you have to merge with a nearby utility. And almost overnight, we'll be able to have thousands and thousands of mergers almost immediately, because local utilities are just either not going to have the money to fix it or want to spend the money to fix it. And so they will match themselves up with another nearby utility, expand the rate base by having more consumers paying in their water bills. You'll have more funds available to fix the problems. This will be a virtuous circle. It makes no sense whatsoever other than for local political purposes by a local mayor or a local city council to continue the system the way it is. Nobody benefits except for the water utilities and the local elected officials. And therefore, this is a change that we will have, and I'm positive about this, that we'll have this in a matter of just a few years.
You're saying that we need a huge amount of energy around this from the public, not unlike the beginning of Earth Day.
Yes, the environmental movement is exactly my model for this, but likewise, lots of other changes we see in society that come about where people think it's a non-issue or they think it's hopeless and it can never change. But this is unlike most other issues that we have in front of us, because everybody drinks water. And once people realize the degree of contaminants that they're getting in their water, they're going to be very unhappy about the fact that they and their children are having their health put at risk.
Seth Siegel is the author of Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink. He spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz, and you'll find more about Siegel's work and his next book at WUWM.com.